The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. So we're recording this on the day that restaurants are opening up again, and so it's all very exciting. But while I'm going to head to a restaurant, I know Jackie's been working hard on some questions and working a little OT with your calculator, because last time I asked her a number of questions, and you've got the answers as to sort of numbers in terms of the fraction of oil sands production, which is about 2.9 million barrels per day or 3% of world production, and how much of that is under net zero emissions and so on and so forth. So what do you have for us?
Okay, yeah, because last time you threw me a curveball there, Peter, but don't worry, I have to figure it all out. So I had said about half of Western Canadian production was backed by net zero emissions. So then I went and looked at just the oil sands piece, like what oil sands companies had committed to net zero. And I came up with 70%. However, there's been some news even in the last few days that it's closer to 90% now, because there was an announcement where one more company we could throw into that group. So that gets us to 90% of oil sands backed by net zero greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, the other thing I wanted to point out is the oil sands represent about half of the emissions from oil and gas in Canada. And oil and gas is about 25% of all Canadian emissions. So that's representing, you know, about 12.5%. Most of that is going to go down to zero emissions between now and 2050.
Which is really quite remarkable. So we had this exciting news yesterday from the five biggest oil sands companies representing 90% of all production, with an initiative called the Pathways Initiative, that they're going to collectively work together to reduce emissions to net zero by 2050. So we're delighted to have with us two guests, one from Cenovus, Rona Del Frari, Chief Sustainability Officer and Senior Vice President, Stakeholder Engagement. Welcome, Rona.
Glad to be here.
And we also have Pam McIntyre from Canadian Natural Resources. She's the Senior Vice President, Safety, Risk Management and Innovation. Welcome, Pam.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so why don't we start out? There's a lot of momentum behind this imperative to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Every industry in Canada is going to have to net out their carbon emissions. It's not just an oil and gas story. We've got real estate, aviation, steel, fertilizer, you name it. And the oil sands segment of the industry, as far as I know, is the first to collectively have a large fraction of the companies declare a consortium to achieve net zero by 2050. So we are delighted to welcome both of you. Maybe we can just start by each of you, maybe start with you, Pam, telling us a little bit about yourself and your role at Canadian Natural.
Okay, well, thanks, Peter. As you said, I'm the Senior Vice President of Safety, Risk Management, and Innovation. And I know that's a mouthful, but basically, in addition to safety and asset integrity, I have our ESG groups and technology and innovation under my umbrella. So in terms of my background, I'm a metallurgical engineer, and I started my career in manufacturing and R&D in the steel industry. And then I focused on asset integrity before expanding into my ESG and technology and innovation roles. So I'd say I've always based my career on wanting to be innovative and really to work inside making positive changes and drive progressive improvements, because I really do care about making a difference. I'm kind of really big on, if you're not part of the solution, then you really are part of the problem.
Well, we need a lot of innovation for sure. And we're going to talk a lot about that. So thanks for that intro.
So Rona, let's hear a little bit about you before we get into the exciting news about your ambitions around greenhouse gas emissions.
Sure. I lead the integration of sustainability into our strategy and our business plans at Cenovus. And that means I work across the company to make sure that all staff understand exactly what their role is in helping Cenovus achieve our sustainability goals. I'm also responsible, as you mentioned, for external engagement, and that means relationships with Indigenous and other communities. I am responsible for our government interactions, our commitments to associations and other third-party organizations, and I oversee internal and external communications. And so with all of those roles, I have to say these days, they all point towards sustainability. And it's really interesting how that has all culminated over the last couple of years in particular. And it's also fascinating as I talk to others in the industry that have this chief sustainability officer role or others, all of our backgrounds. I'm a journalist by training initially, and look at Pam's an engineer. And so it just shows you that when you're leading sustainability, it is a complex challenge and issue for all of us. And a lot of different backgrounds are important, I think.
Well, especially the ability to communicate it effectively. So imagine the journalistic side of you comes out as well, because these are complex subjects, as you said, and they've got to be communicated so all stakeholders, the people, understand what's going on.
It is really important to communicate it well, and I'm really learning that, and also to engage with others, because everybody wants the quick fix. This is not a quick fix. Things like climate change, there is no quick fix.
All right, well, let's get into the announcement. Could you just tell us the companies that are involved? And this only happened yesterday, but what's the response been so far?
So basically, there's five companies that are involved in the Alliance for Pathways, and that includes Canadian Natural Resources, Cenovus Energy, Meg Energy, Imperial, and Suncor Energy. And as Jackie mentioned, that represents about 90% of Canada's oil sands production.
You know, further to Jackie's question, so the news came out and different interpretations of it. What's your sense of the response overall? What have you been hearing, and what sort of emails and social media and what have you, or have you been getting in terms of your announcement?
We have been receiving overwhelmingly positive response, I have to say, from all stakeholders. And our companies, our combined companies, did fairly extensive outreach yesterday because we wanted to hear people's opinions and we wanted to be able to answer any questions that people had. And the feedback that we were hearing is that it's wonderful to see this oil sands sector collaborating on something so important for our industry and our country. As you mentioned, Peter, there really isn't another example of this level of collaboration amongst peers that we've identified either. There's recognition of the opportunity that this brings for additional collaboration with governments, indigenous communities, clean tech sector, many others. And it's also a recognition that Canada is going to be extremely challenged to meet its energy, economic, and climate commitments without an initiative such as Pathways. So that's the type of feedback that I've been hearing.
Let's just talk a little bit about the Pathways project. It really focuses on building a trunk line to move CO2 emissions from the Fort McMurray area to the Cold Lake area. But let's start with the engineer, Pam, the capturing of carbon. Most of the emissions are going to be produced from generating steam, at least for the in-situ projects. And I know that there's various emissions sort of in the mining operations as well. Is it difficult to capture all those emissions over like a big section of our province? I mean, the oil sands region is quite a large area.
Yeah, that's a great question, Jackie. Essentially, as you mentioned, the Pathways initiative really is based on the anchor of the vision is really around that major carbon capture, utilization, and storage trunk line. So that's going to be running from Fort McMurray down into the Cold Lake region. And we've chosen the sort of the routing that we're looking at is to make sure that we're able to pick up from each of the major facilities and also have some ability there as we lead into that carbon sequestration hub in the Cold Lake region, that it's going to be an open system. So it is going to enable us to be picking up from other sectors, so under industries where they are doing carbon capture. And where you're asking about how difficult or how easy it is, well, that's really why the beauty of this plan is that there is no single pathway. So there's going to be multiple things that we're going to be looking at as abilities to pick up large captures as well as small. So it is going to be very much looking at that incremental piece and putting it all together to add up to really have that bigger impact.
And I think what I would add to that is that while most definitely the CCUS aspect of it is the central part and it will be our initial project, we did call it Pathways because there are many pathways to getting to net zero, and it will go beyond CCS as well.
When we talk about pathways, some of the steam generation will be substituted with, say, small modular nuclear reactors. Some of it will be captured off the flue stack. Some of it will follow other technologies to basically reduce the emissions. Is that what you talk about when you say pathways?
That's correct. I mean, as you've said, Peter, it's not just one-dimensional. This is looking at lots of different alternatives. Mm-hmm. And I think there's even alternatives that we don't even have on the table yet. I mean, that's really what the opportunity is as well.
Right. So you're going to get started. You've already scoped out this hub type system and a network of pipelines to meet up at Cold Lake and the carbon then reinjected back into the geological formations. In your press release, you reference Norway and the Netherlands. And actually, I believe the UK as well have done this in the North Sea. Tell us about what you've learned and what's been done there and how some of that knowledge is informing your thinking. Maybe start with you, Rona, on that.
The most important aspect that we've been looking at some of those projects internationally in other oil-producing jurisdictions around the world has to do with how the government has been working with industry to partner and to achieve these. And any projects that we've seen that have had success have had significant government involvement from a funding perspective, but also through the development of policies that you need these policies to encourage these multi-decade, multi-billion dollar emissions reduction projects to proceed. Mm-hmm. And so we've really looked at some of that modeling about how we will work with governments. And that's what we've been talking to our governments about as well.
Now, hydrogen's kind of an interesting technology. We've actually had a couple of announcements here in Alberta around the Edmonton area. One was about a month ago with Suncor and ATCO, and we just had one with Air Liquide a couple of days ago. Do you think hydrogen could fit into these plans as well in terms of your pathways to get to net zero and maybe transport CO2 that would come from blue hydrogen on your pipeline?
So with respect to hydrogen, definitely. Hydrogen does fit in. Fits because it provides that potential for blending into fuels to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. And there's also the potential use of hydrogen for fuel cells as well. So what I'd say here is, again, lots of potential for technology development in this area. And we really will be fleshing this out as the initiative progresses and see what makes a good fit for each of our companies and for as well while we're working with the government through all of this.
One thing that is important for people to understand is that the assumption is often that, well, it's an oil sands facility, so they all look alike. They don't all look alike. There's different reservoirs. There's different facilities that are needed at different sites. And so that's why there is not just one technology that's going to work for every single facility along the way. Again, back to that pathways with an S on it. Reason mm-hmm. for this? Mm-hmm. And so we need a lot of feasibility studies to happen over the coming years. Each company needs to figure out at their own facility what makes the best sense for their business. And then we need to bring this into the joint alliance that we've created so that we're sharing the knowledge that we gain along the way.
And you're sharing the infrastructure too, which is really important. It's not like each company within the oil sands consortium, as well as other companies that are non-oil sands, all collectively are chipping into a common infrastructure rather than everybody going and doing their own thing, which makes it a lot cheaper.
Correct.
Yeah.
That really is the idea here, is to make sure that we're being as efficient as possible, and that really is hinged upon sharing of infrastructure and sharing of ideas and technology.
Yeah, and this is, I think, such an important thing to recognize, because the history of the oil industry, and even more recently, say in the last two decades, the rapid rise of the oil sands facilities, say between circa 2005, 2020, we had so many projects that were built, and each company built their own facilities, their own power plants, because they're so competitive, they built everything themselves. So it is really quite unique to create this consortium to share facilities, not only amongst yourself, but with others. But that leads me to the big question. The press release that you put out says the initiative is ambitious and will require significant investment on both the part of industry and government. So it begs the obvious question, how much money are we talking about?
Well, that is a good question. And as you can imagine, when you're estimating the costs of technologies that are still at the emerging stage in many cases and have never been implemented at our types of facilities in other cases and go out over 30 years, we're making the best assumptions that we can right now with the knowledge that we have. So not to say that extensive modeling hasn't happened, it has, But right now we're estimating that over the 30-year period, it's going to take about $75 billion of investment, of combined investment, to achieve what we need to do to get our industry, our oil sands sector, to net zero. Now, you know, that's about $2.5 billion a year. Some years maybe more, depending on which technology is being implemented then. Some maybe less. As you well are aware of, Jackie and Peter, as technologies go down the spectrum, they start to get less costly. And so that's the kind of numbers we're looking at now. You know, when you look to some of those successful partnerships that we've seen in other countries that are reducing emissions in their oil and gas sector, usually the governments, you know, have been partnering for about 2/3 to 3/4 of the upfront costs of a project. So those are the types of discussions that we're having with our government partners.
But there's got to be some sort of sharing in a sense that a lot of these other countries, the oil industries are state-owned, whereas our industry, actually, I mean, the Canadian and American industries are very unique in a sense that they are completely free market, right? So there's a sort of public sector versus private sector dance that has to happen. In a place like Norway, basically, I mean, it's all state-owned largely. So it's out of one pocket into the other, right?
We're definitely talking about a joint investment here. And our companies have put in billions of dollars as a combined effort over the years. So investing to improve our environmental performance, nothing new. You know, 12 years ago, we formed Canada's Oil Sands Innovation Alliance as a group of companies in the oil sands to do just that. So we absolutely plan to continue to invest in this too. We just can't do it alone. We need to remain globally competitive, and we can't do this by ourselves, and thus the collaborative effort.
Just to put that in perspective, you know, $75 billion sounds like a huge number, but we're expecting the revenue from the total oil and gas industry this year. Now, it's a good year for prices, but it's well in excess of $100 billion, and the cash flow being $70 billion. So it just kind of puts you in perspective, you know, the cash flow generation of the industry relative to that. Over 30 years, you'd get that annually, right? So kind of put some perspective on it. And another kind of interesting point is how much money has been invested in the oil sands, you know, in the peak years, as much as $34 billion annually was being spent on capital programs associated with building out the production facilities.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, these are big dollars, but this is an industry that knows how to deploy the big dollars and put it to work. These are things that we got to sort of think about and digest in terms of how the spending goes over time, how fast the emissions can be reduced, but at the same time, what economic opportunities are produced at the same time.
And we're really looking at this as an investment, because think about the $3-something trillion that we expect to be contributing over that same time period to Canada's GDP. So you invest a few billion dollars to get us to net zero that we're all striving to achieve, and the result is trillions that go back into the Canadian economy.
I appreciate you saying that, Rona, because I think it's really also important to add on to that, that a lot of what we're talking about here, the technologies and a lot of the development, is not just for the oil and gas industry. This is all transferable, and it can help to bring along other industries and other sectors in Canada. So this is just really good for Canada.
So the naysayers would say you're going to generate $75 billion. Well, actually, that's the whole industry. That's including conventional oil and gas. But the naysayers would basically say you pay for the whole thing. What do you say to that?
Well, the naysayers often have ideas, and sometimes we would love to have them come to the table with some of the solutions, I would say, first of all. But absolutely, our industry, it's a volatile industry. There's ups and downs to it. Right now, prices are good and our cash flow is stronger. This can't be done, though, in isolation of when you think about the entire global oil and gas sector. And so if it becomes too costly to do business here in Canada, the investors will go to somewhere that is less costly. And that jurisdiction might not be a jurisdiction that is tackling climate change. And so we want to make sure that we maintain a strong investment environment here. And that means that our costs can't be extremely high compared to other jurisdictions. And at the same time, we want to be tackling this issue.
Yeah. I think there's another dynamic that's important for our audience to recognize. And that is that ultimately, as I already mentioned, the Canadian oil and gas industry is an independent free market oil and gas industry that is ultimately controlled by the investors. And the investors are demanding a return in the form of dividends and share buybacks and what have you. And ultimately, they're the ones that are deciding where the capital goes. And so it's going to be interesting to see, not only in the oil and gas industry, but, you know, this is going to hit real estate, aviation, forestry, like you name, agriculture. And it's going to be interesting to see how the free market investors are going to react to the really difficult task of decarbonization and who pays for it. Because the oil and gas industry is not going to be the only one that goes to the government and says, hey, wait a minute, you want to decarbonize? Help us pay for it.
You know, I would say, though, the government can't afford to pay for everyone to reduce their emissions. So the way to do it is to create policies that will bring private capital in. And the federal government has put in a number of policies over the last 6 months, really. The Clean Fuel Standard, the announcement of getting to $170 carbon tax, and just with the budget, the idea that there would be a tax incentive for carbon capture storage. We talked about that a couple of episodes ago. Mm-hmm. And those three things could be layered together to hopefully drive private capital into these projects. I don't know if either of you have a comment on, you know, those policies, and are they going to help you be able to fund some of this with private capital as well?
We're always open to the idea of other investors coming in and collaborating with us on this. And absolutely, in some of these technologies that we'll be deploying at our sites, there's huge opportunity for that private capital, and you see it happening. So the clean tech sector has to be part of that. That's the obvious, easier route for private capital to join us on this, is to work jointly with us and develop some of these technologies.
I'll just add a little bit to what Rona has said there too. That's part of why we're forming the networks that we're forming. So networks such as CLISIA, networks such as CRIN, Clean Resource Innovation Network, these are really critical to getting that cross-industry working together, collaborating there. I don't want to sound too overly rosy here, but it is about getting the right people connected and making sure that we are bringing in the right investment. Right. So I do see opportunities, definitely. Yeah.
So policies, finance, in other words, where the money is going to come from, are issues. But there's also other issues that need to be explored. In the press release, you talk about dependable access to carbon sequestration rights. What does that mean?
When we're talking about the rights, exactly, we are talking about, we have this reservoir, we have the right to put our CO2 into that reservoir. And so why we need that, obviously needs really strong policy to govern it. And we need this policy to make it a process and a system within Alberta that is simple. Complexity adds costs. Our overall goal is to get to net zero emissions, and we want to do that at the lowest cost.
So if I interpret this correctly, so in this province, like many oil-producing regions, we've got a century of history of leasing land rights, subsurface mineral rights, and that's all extremely well understood in terms of who owns what parcels of land subsurface and what rights they have associated with that. So now we're talking about something that was not considered by our regulators until recently, and that is, who owns the rights to be able to bury the carbon back into that geology? And what are the obligations and legalities of all that? Is that what you're getting at?
That's what we mean. And it's something that has been studied in many other jurisdictions around the world, because carbon capture and storage is nothing that's new. And so it's not just the rights of I can put my carbon dioxide into that reservoir, but it's also the governance of, and then who's responsible for it over the long term?
Well, and who owns it? What happens if it leaks? Who's liable? And that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, and we know, you know, this has been proven to be very safe. And we know we're experts in geology. That is what our industry does really well. And so we know what characteristics to look for in the various reservoirs for which ones will make sense to store our CO2. That's why our group has chosen the Cold Lake area. There's great sequestration there. We want to talk to the local Indigenous communities and other stakeholders about it. But that's the place that we're selecting right now as part of our proposal.
All right. I want to ask you a question. I know you've had a lot of good reactions, but I looked at Twitter and, of course, the environmental groups, some of them said CCS is just a way to extend the life of the oil industry. And, you know, we shouldn't be putting the money into that. We should be putting it into renewables and other clean energy. What's your reaction to some of those perspectives?
What I'd say with that is that oil and gas development is absolutely compatible with climate objectives. So we need to really be aware that Canada doesn't need to give up the substantial, the social economic benefits provided by our oil resources when the resources can be produced with net zero carbon emissions. So what that actually also means is that demand for oil continues well into the future, and it's in our best interest to make sure that we're securing it responsibly by responsibly produced oil, and that it also benefits our country's economic growth. As we've said already, what will happen is that demand doesn't go away, but the supplier actually shifts, and it can be shifting to a supplier, global supplier, that doesn't have the same level of responsibility that we have here in Canada. So we just think it, again, makes sense to keep it in Canada and make sure that we are benefiting here in Canada from this.
And what about the Scope 3 emissions? I think your net zero target is around your direct emissions. Is there any aspirations around trying to reduce the emissions associated beyond your own direct emissions and offset some of the emissions associated with when people use your products?
So with respect to this initiative, it is focused on Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions. And the reason it is because that's what's within our control. Scope 3 emissions, that's really quite complex and how exactly to deal with it. So we're not saying that that's nothing that we're concerned about or that is going to down the road play into this. But right now, we want to get started on an area where we really feel that we can have a substantial impact. And that really was what this Pathways Initiative was about, was to make sure that we had something that was real, that wasn't just way out in the future or just some idea. We wanted something where we could have an actionable plan where we can actually move the needle and make a difference.
So when you have this level of investment, $75 billion or how much it's going to cost, that also has a lot of spin-offs. Employment. Can you comment on sort of like the positive economic impact of what this could do in terms of repiping and rejigging our hydrocarbon economy?
I think that the employment opportunities and the business opportunities are a really exciting part of this, because it's not only going to happen in Alberta. Some of these technologies that we need can come from across the country. There's great ideas everywhere, so we say bring them on. And so I think that our staff are excited. There's a lot of transferable skills from the oil and gas industry to, you know, what is being called the clean tech industry, but it's really just the application of different technologies to reduce emissions and other environmental footprint. And so there will be jobs. Now, we haven't done enough modeling to even try to give an estimate of what kinds of jobs this initiative will create. But the other important thing is that it is crucial for the long-term success of our industry, for the oil and gas production, to be pursuing this vision that we have. And so it's not only going to create new jobs that are focused on the technologies, but it is going to continue on with those oil and gas production jobs, those Indigenous business opportunities that our industry is so proud of having formed with our Indigenous neighbors. So there is a huge amount of employment and business opportunity through this.
Mm-hmm. And then there's just like the acronym used to be CCS, carbon capture and sequestration. In other words, capture the carbon and sequester it. But now it's become CCUS, where the U is the utilization of the captured CO2 to make other products, all the way from soap to carbon fiber. So are you thinking that your companies are going to actually diversify out and start to make other products beyond just petroleum fuels?
So, Peter, I'm glad you brought up the U. For me, that's kind of the very exciting part about this as well, is it really is that transforming the carbon into products. And it's estimated that that's really close to a $6 trillion U.S. dollar opportunity. So when you're asking, are we going to be diversifying as companies into these areas? Well, I guess I would just say you never know. But apart from that, it really is going to be allowing, spreading the wealth, if you want to say, from that perspective, where there's opportunity for other companies, other industries to start to take the carbon, the CO2, and to transfer it, as you say, into other products. So into items such as soap, I think hand sanitizers, there's just a whole raft of potential products there. We're talking carbon fiber. We're talking potential fuels. There's like a lot of opportunity that we're looking at here. And again, that is the part that does get to be pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we could actually potentially have like a secondary tertiary manufacturing industry that centers around that kind of thing. So it's really quite exciting.
Yeah, it is really exciting. And I think you're proving real time that the old perceptions around the oil sands are quickly changing. And this industry is going to look a lot different in 10 years than the perception is today. And that's going to continue to improve over the next 30 years. You know, I think this is going to go a long way to reduce friction with the oil sands industry and the rest of Canada. I mean, a big part of the problem was that oil sands was growing their emissions while Canada wanted to reduce the emissions. So it could show here that the oil sands industry is going to contribute in a big way and faster than anyone thinks in terms of reducing the emissions and helping Canada meet those goals. And at the same time, we're going to bring all this investment, you know, this $75 billion potentially of money and capital that would be spent in Alberta and provide jobs, but also expertise that maybe we could build on to export some of our technologies and expertise around the world. So this is just really exciting news, and I want to congratulate yourselves as well as your companies and the five oil sands producers that stepped up to this goal. We really look forward to seeing you deliver it over the coming years.
We're very excited as well, and we're not just excited for us, we're excited for the country. This is really putting us in a leadership position.
Great. Well, Pam and Rona, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you to our listeners. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.